After that nice introduction, I can't avoid opening by quoting from the lying corporate media, which I got a clip from. I don't know how many tens of thousands of talks I've given over the last 40 years, but I've learned that when I don't have time to prepare a talk, the easiest way to arrange it is just to read the morning newspaper. And that almost invariably, never fails, there's always something there that you can talk about. So this morning, no exception. Jack just introduced me without thinking about it. This is the Globe and Mail. I didn't. From yesterday, it's interesting and worth thinking about. And the report begins by saying that George Bush called the broader war on the inescapable calling of our generation, warning that human civilization itself is at stake. Okay. Now, he doesn't remember because he was probably drunk at a frat party at Yale at the time, but. The people around him and his speechwriters and handlers remember very well that they wrote the same words for his colleagues over 20 years ago, back 1981, when they came into office, pretty much the same people, and immediately opened by declaring a war on terror, which was the plague of the modern age. A war against civilization itself, which we had to battle relentlessly. And they fought that war on terror for the first 12 years they were in office, and they've picked it up again. And if we want to have any idea what they're doing, we should have a look at the 12 years in which they waged the war on terror. It was a real one. Our friend from the FMLN can tell us about it. They were one of the prime targets of the war on terror. Actually, his talk reminded me of a painting I have in my office, given to me by a Jesuit priest who painted it. It's a painting of the angel of death holding a scythe. And below him is a portrait of Archbishop Romero. His assassination opened that great decade. Alongside of him are the six Jesuit intellectuals who were murdered, had their brains blown out, ending the decade of the war on terror, and their housekeeper and her daughter who were caught in the crossfire. That frames the decade on terror pretty well. And there's a side comment to make about it. I've had it for years. And I've noticed that everyone who comes into my office, everyone from south of the Rio Grande who comes into my office knows exactly what it is. And virtually no one from the United States, or I'm sorry to say Canada, knows what it is. We don't pay attention to our own crimes. We don't count them up. They don't exist. That's a war against terror. And El Salvador was only one target. They only had about 70,000 people slaughtered in the war on terror. The rest of Central America added up to who knows. Since we don't count, we don't know. Maybe 200,000. And they're real achievements. Somebody has a sign there saying Bush is the real terrorist. Well, actually, he's a convicted terrorist, he and his accomplices. It's the only government in history that has been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism, namely the attack against the war on against Nicaragua. Would have been condemned by the Security Council, except that the U.S. vetoed two resolutions with Britain kindly abstaining. Condemned repeatedly by the General Assembly, but it doesn't matter because it's air crimes, so it's not terrorism. And Central America is only one of the places where they waged the war on terror. They also waged it, for example, in Southern Africa. There was a during the Reagan years, there was a policy called constructive engagement with Southern Africa, Southeast African apartheid regime. During just those years, constructive engagement, the South African regime killed about 1.5 million people and caused about $60 billion of damage in the surrounding countries alone. Forget what was happening in South Africa. Well, the moderate, who is now the Secretary of State, he comes out of central casting as a moderate, was the National Security Advisor toward the end when the worst atrocities were being carried out. And the Pentagon in 1988 declared Nelson Mandela's African National Congress to be the most, one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. This was at the time when the Reagan administration, the guys now in office, were finding ways to circumvent the congressional sanctions against aid and trade with South Africa, which they were able to increase while the press, what was it, corporate lying press, since I'm quoting it, I don't have to take responsibility for it. They quietly managed not to see what was happening. And the same was going on in the Middle East. The same was going on in Southeast Asia with Canada's very strong support during the near genocide in East Timor. And we can go on. That was the first war on terror, the war to save civilization from the plague of terror, assault by barbarians who are about to destroy civilization. So there's really nothing new is going on. The speechwriters can just plagiarize. In fact, it's the same words. Louder? Can't hear me? Something going on? Oh, okay. Sorry. If you can't hear me, you can join my wife. She always complains. She always complains that I'm mumbling. She can't hear me. Actually, she actually went to a doctor who pays attention to your ears, I forget, to find out if she was losing her hearing. And he gave her a hearing test. And he asked her why she thought so. And she said she could never hear her husband. And he gave her the test. And she said, well, your husband's mumbling. Just like so sorry if you can't hear me. The war on terror is very much like this one in other respects, many other respects, not just what's happening in Iraq. And it's worth paying attention to it. You know, we're not supposed to pay attention to what we've done in the past for good reasons. You learn too much. But we don't have to follow those rules. It's what schools are for and journals and so on, but we don't have to follow them. The first war on terror began in 1981. And you'll remember there was another brave cowboy back then. He was hiding in the White House, surrounded by tanks in 1981 to protect him from the Libyan hitmen who were roaming the streets of Washington trying to assassinate our leader. Luckily, he managed to escape. 2 years later, in 1983, he sent 6,000 special forces to Grenada, where they got 8,000 medals of honor for having overcome the resistance of a couple of dozen, Cuban construction workers. They were, still can't hear me? I do. Try this. You're making me feel like I'm in my living room or my wife can't hear me. I'm up to 1983 when the United States was seriously threatened, much worse than Saddam Hussein. There was in Grenada, the nutmeg capital of the world, there was an airbase being built from which, by the British, but didn't matter, from which the Russians might bomb us. And that's a serious threat. Most Americans probably thought Grenada was in Africa somewhere, but in fact, it's pretty close. But fortunately, the cowboy sent 6,000 special forces who overcame the resistance of a couple of dozen construction workers, killed 40 or 50 of one another in the process, and got 8,000 medals of honor. And we were standing tall, as the president said, saved by the courage of the cowboy. A year later, a national emergency was declared in the United States with words that should be familiar from last year. In fact, the wording of the declaration of the national emergency was approximately the same as the wording of the congressional authorization for the war in Iraq. Almost the same. Reagan declared a national emergency because of the unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua, which was 2 days' driving time from Texas. And as the Secretary of the State said, they were waving their copies of Mein Kampf as they were coming to conquer us. But somehow we escaped that one too. Then came others, including domestic ones. George Bush, number one, was elected in 1988 on a race card, straight. He's going to save your sister from being raped by black criminals, Willie Horton, if you remember. That was, you got to be afraid of that one. There's nothing new going on. This is just a repetition of a very familiar formula. If you're shafting people, and they were shafting the population, they suffered badly in those years, you got to frighten them. There's no other known way to keep population under control. And it's happening now. It's happening now. This article goes on to describe the president's criticism of Spanish. And that's an interesting one. He's criticizing Spain, and the article reads, "It's a veiled warning to Spain, where leaders have threatened to withdraw their troops from Iraq." That's the conventional falsification, and a very interesting one. The Spanish Prime Minister didn't threaten to withdraw his troops from Iraq. He threatened to withdraw his troops from U.S. command in Iraq. That's quite a difference, and a crucial difference. In fact, what the press should be reporting is that the Spanish people took exactly the same position as the vast majority of the people of the United States, who as far back as last April were saying U.S. ought to get out. This is whatever happened for it or against it. This should be under the administration of the United Nations until you can turn it over to the people of Iraq. Well, that's what the people of Spain voted for the other day. So there's unity between the people of Spain and the people of the United States, but you're not going to find it described in the lying corporate media. We're not supposed to know that. We're not supposed to know that, but we should. It's important. And that's what the war is about right now. I mean, you can think whatever you like about what happened. But the issue now, and since the bombs start falling, is who is going to rule Iraq? And with all the vacillations of policy of the United States and before them Britain and Canada quietly in the background, with all the vacillations of policy, that's been the issue for over 80 years. Britain created Iraq. It wasn't a country. They drew the boundaries so that they could get the oil of the north and not the Turks, and so that the new country would be under their control because it wouldn't have access to the sea. That's why Kuwait was put in there, the Principality of Kuwait, to block access to the sea so the new country would be a client. Actually, what they called it was an independent state. It had a parliament and a constitution and all sorts of nice things. But the British, in their own internal documents, said it's an Arab facade that the British would rule behind various constitutional fictions. That was in secret. But the Iraqis certainly knew about it. Question is, who's going to run it?